I will call the meeting to order at 40 past the hour. We have, in your package, members, we have minutes from the last meeting. I'll entertain a motion to approve those minutes. Or make any corrections that might be necessary. Thank you, Representative Leader, for making that motion. Any discussion or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you for approving the minutes. Just for our edification and members of the audience, for the past several months, the Aviation Subcommittee of the House Transportation Committees have been exploring land use issues around airports around the state and around the Twin Cities. We're primarily concerned about future planning and somehow structuring zoning and land use laws and how regional airport authorities can use those to head off problems with noise, growth, and encroachment on airspace and airport activities, and how we can do some sort of planning, some sort of zoning, some sort of regulation that helps communities and airports live together more compatibly. One of the issues we bumped up against is the very twitchy issue of noise. Of course, where we have the most experience with the noise issues right here in our own backyard with MSP. And so for the sake of the technical edification, I guess is the way to say it, of this committee, I've invited our friends from MAC to come here this morning and explain the FAA noise program, how noise is measured, how it impacts the communities, and so on and so forth. So this will be a rather technical explanation this morning, presentation this morning. This is not, I got to repeat, not a public hearing. There will be no public testimony, and we will not delve into value judgments or anything like that this morning. This will be pretty much technical in nature. Questions will be limited to the members around this panel. That's the folks that have the right to ask questions this morning. With that, I want to say thank you to Mr. Jeff Hamill, Mr. Nigel Finney for coming over from the Metropolitan Airports Commission to make this presentation this morning. Members, you have in front of you, because we don't have the PowerPoint room this morning, we're going to do it the old-fashioned way with ink on paper, make notes, ask questions, and if you would approach the now live microphone, gentlemen, and begin your presentation, we'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, can I just... thank you for holding this, because this is an important issue, and I, several of us over here really do appreciate moving forward on this, so thanks.
Oh, you're certainly welcome, and recognizing your districts and where they are, I appreciate the sensitivities. I just want to add that there are many of us that are fascinated with what's going on and interested and intrigued to know how it applies to Ridgefield, Minneapolis, Bloomington, and so on. But again, I just want to underscore the underlying premise for this discussion moves forward to Rochester, Duluth, Marshall, Worthington, St. Cloud, so on and so forth. So, but you're welcome, Representative Thiessen.
Don't forget Wilmer, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we won't forget Wilmer Prairie.
No
Prairie minutes.
Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. For those that don't know me, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And with me today is Mr. Nigel Finney, Deputy Executive Director for Planning and Environment. Nigel is an important part of this discussion because he is responsible for and has been responsible for more than two decades the entire noise abatement environmental programs of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. To take you back a bit in a little bit of history, first of all, I'd like to, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is also talk a bit about NAC's program, because what it does is kind of follow the line of technical programs you talked about and kind of a history of whole development at the federal level and at the state level on noise mitigation programs. So I can talk about the NAC as an example. That would work quite well. Nigel and I both joined the Metropolitan Airports Commission in 1977 as managers. I was the Commission's first manager of Noise Abatement Environmental Affairs. So we both go back a long way, approaching 28 years of service in the organization. And we've watched virtually the majority of our entire environmental program develop and evolve over our time with the Commission. So I think that there's a good resource in Nigel's very, very clear memory and in our presentation today. I first have to tell you, thank you for this opportunity. On behalf of our Chair, Vicki Grunseth, and our Commission members, we appreciate the opportunity to join you and discuss the noise program today. Just to put MSP in perspective, just for a moment, the Minneapolis-St. Paul Metropolitan Airports Commission was created in 1943, so we're now 60 years old this year, actually last year. The organization has had quite an extraordinary reputation, quite a history overall. People who preceded us did a fine job of establishing the organization and its general direction and its performance. We were created by this body in 1943 as a solution to competitive, destructive competitive environments between the city of St. Paul and Minneapolis, trying to secure aviation services for the metropolitan community. We had Minneapolis and St. Paul building similar facilities and runways competing for one another. And finally, the legislature stepped in under the leadership of Governor Harold Stassen in 1943 and basically created the commission, which was the first commission in Minnesota. And that 15-member board today serves this community, I think, very, 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 very well. MSP is the eighth largest airport in the United States. It is the 12th largest airport in the world. We have over 34 million passengers a year. We peaked at about 36.5 million passengers in the year 2000. Slowing economy of 2001, along with the terrorist events of 9/11, dramatically impacted the industry. So we all slipped back a bit across the entire country. But in fact, we see today a rebuilding of that infrastructure and that system, and we see ourselves returning to the same levels of 2000 and expect to grow and continue to grow beyond that. The timing of your discussion today in these hearings is important, and it's more important than I think you realize, because in the next 60 days, the Metropolitan Airports Commission will make one of the most significant decisions in an environment that it's made in many, many years. The first important decision, of course, was the whole noise mitigation program, which has led the commission into a more than $300 million noise mitigation program. But the decision that we're going to be making in the next 60 days is to determine what kind of mitigation will take place beyond the 65 DNL contour out to the 60 DNL contour. So your hearing today is right on the cusp and the cutting edge of the next significant noise abatement and mitigation decision of the commission. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. We've given you a handout, and I'll simply talk through the handout in brief terms. And Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, if you'd like to interrupt, please do, because I think it's important, given the nature of the discussion, to tackle concerns or questions that members may have while we're discussing the issue. It's tough to go back after a half hour of talking and try to recapture the discussion. So I'm comfortable with that, if you don't mind.
That would be fine. Thank you, Mr. Hamill. And members, let's be a little less formal. I'm going to be paying pretty close attention, so if I'm not looking at you and you need to speak, just raise attention to yourself and we'll jump in with questions. Thank you.
Overall, as a matter of introduction and kind of talking about the overall noise program, let me start by talking about operational measures. And I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, and if you do need to stop me, please do so. There are several ways of looking at noise, and our efforts over the past have focused on primarily operational measures as an airport proprietor. The operational measures included a program called the Preferential Runway System, the Runway Use System, Eagan Mendota Heights Corridor, and now we're working on finalizing the Runway 17 departure procedures. Well, what are these programs? Going back into the 1970s, we have a thing called the Preferential Runway System, which is basically preferring to use certain runways over others. And I think the simplest way to describe this is to simply say that the Preferential Runway System basically tried to emphasize runway use over less populated areas around the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. And if we had to use runways that went over more densely populated regions, what we would do is try to spread the traffic in most cases to try to minimize impact for residents who live below the flight path. The runway use system is a little bit different in that we determine how to use certain runways to maximize the operational efficiency of the airport, and it was a refinement of the preferential runway system that was described a moment ago. Fortunately for MSP, to the east of the airport, the cities of Mendota Heights and Eagan had substantial open space, and both cities had developed and zoned a commercial corridor directly across the river from the airport. And this became a logical and a very convenient center corridor for traffic to focus and to concentrate. And as a result, to the east of the airport, when we depart and arrive, we come basically in over a very narrow corridor of commercial property, which means significantly less impact for residents who live in Mendota Heights and Eagan. Just the opposite is true on the other end of those parallel runways, where we have the city of Minneapolis and North Richfield, where there is no corridor, there is no commercial space for all practical purposes, and about the most advantageous benefit we have is the existence of the Crosstown Highway and the connection between 35W and the Crosstown at that well-known interchange. Other than that noise-generating bit of busy traffic lane, the rest of South Minneapolis and North Ridgefield is heavy-density residential development. And as a result, the departure procedures toward the northwest direction from the airport are not focused on a corridor like Mendota Heights and Eagan, but rather they're dispersed very aggressively and very quickly when they come off the runways northbound, departing toward the northwest. And so you'll see a great dispersion of traffic coming off the northwest end versus that corridor focus.
Mr. Hamill.
Yes.
Talk about wind direction and how it impacts your preferred runway. I know it working with commercial airliners, their capacity for handling crosswinds and tailwinds and quartering tailwinds so is a lot different than smaller planes. But
Mr. Chair, members, let me just, by way of qualification, I spent 30 years flying large airplanes in the military. And from the Boeing series airplanes to Lockheed aircraft, and spent 21 years flying with the Minneapolis St. Paul Airport with the Air Force Reserve. So I'm familiar with both small airplanes because I'm a small airplane pilot, and I'm also a military pilot flying large airplanes. And basically the rules don't change, whether you're flying a single-engine, two-passenger recreational aircraft or you're flying military transport. All aircraft are designed to take off and land going into the wind. So typically in the colder environment, the colder climate, we have our winds prevailing from the north-northwest coming toward the airport from the northwest. And you'll see in the winter months taking off more frequently toward the northwest. In the summertime, when the winds shift to more of a southerly flow, you'll see us departing toward the south and the southeast, taking advantage of the southerly flow of winds. But the determination as to which runway is to be used is made by the FAA and the pilot. And the FAA will make a recommendation to the pilot as to which runway is the current active runway, but the pilot responsible for the aircraft will make the ultimate decision as to which runway he or she will depart upon. And runway direction and wind are very, very closely linked.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
On the issue of preferential runways, maybe if you could just go over a quick history of this, because, you know, anecdotally, I attended college in St. Paul in the late 70s, and it seemed like a lot of traffic was directed over, you know, Highland Park. I went to McAllister, a lot of low-flying, yes, even heavy jets. And now I live in South Minneapolis, and it seems like the traffic that perhaps was approaching over St. Paul during then is now coming over Minneapolis if the wind is in a southerly direction. Is that true? Do you still, is the main approach vector now over South Minneapolis as opposed to St. Paul? When did that change? Has it changed?
If you could, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein.
It's personal, Frank.
They follow me. I'll
have a snort in the
prairie, though. Back when you go to McAllister.
Yeah. We have a program known as a Hornstein effect. And basically, whether Representative Hornstein moves or something, fine. Yeah. Actually, your observation is surprisingly accurate. If we go back to the 1960s into the early 1970s, runway 422, which is the runway that runs from Highland Park to across the airport to the northeast toward the southwest toward the Richfield and South Richfield and Bloomington. That runway was the longest runway in the airport back in the 60s, one of the longest runways, and was a very highly utilized runway. Some 38%, I think 35 to 38% of the traffic in the late 60s actually arrived and departed over the city of St. Paul. But as we expanded the parallel runways, it went from the northwest to the southeast. We saw, which was more in line with the prevailing wind conditions, we saw a shift take place from traffic over St. Paul's Highland Park to the predominant traffic being over South Minneapolis and Eagan and Mendota Heights. And I think it's pretty safe to say that over 95% of all flight operations today take place either arriving or departing over Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis and North Ridgefield, and Mendota Heights and North Eagan. And that is more in line with the prevailing wind conditions and is a more ideal operating scenario, and that's why we have two runways pointed in that direction versus one runway toward Highland Park. But your recollection is completely accurate.
Mr. Hamill, before you get back on to your program here, another technical question about the noise of takeoffs and landings. Is the noise intensity different, the impact different on a landing approach versus a takeoff departure?
It is. A little bit of history again. If you go back to the 60s and early 70s, when 909 first came to the Airports Commission, the vast majority of complaints that we received were on landing. I was the manager of noise abatement, and I would say that of the 150 phone calls you receive in a day, most folks complained about landing noise, not departure noise. Because the landing noise at that time was a very loud, shrilling sort of a front-end noise as the aircraft approached, and you could hear it coming and coming closer and closer, and then overhead it was very, very loud. And as it passed overhead, you got the kind of the exhaust and the tail noise, which was also loud, but it was the arrival noise that was most disturbing. Today, it's just the opposite. With the technology and the engine designs from noise mitigation that's taken place, now we find people primarily complaining about departure noise, and that's the high thrust settings of aircraft on departure. Generally speaking, there are two different types of noise, but I think we should talk about today because that's what the community experiences. Yeah. For the most part, noise is significantly lower on arrivals for aircraft, and as a result, the only thing that really causes a serious concern is the fact that arrivals are concentrated over the same flight path day after day, hour after hour, because the aircraft are flying an electronic course or a line or a guide that takes them into the airport, and that electronic course that they're flying, known as Instrument Landing System, the ILS, is very, very precise. It is so precise that it'll get an airplane down to 200 feet off the ground on center line with the runway, prepared to land under no visibility conditions until you get to the 200-foot point. And when you did gain visibility of the runway, you are virtually on center line in a position to land the airplane. And that precision goes all the way out anywhere from 5 to 10 miles. So if you live in South Minneapolis, for example, and we're landing over South Minneapolis in a given day under poor weather conditions, you can literally hear the airplanes going over the same houses, one after another, every 45 seconds to a minute and a half during the peak hours. The different facts, so that's a lower noise level, but it's the frequency and the consistency. Okay. Neighbors two blocks, three blocks away are not bothered by that noise, but if you happen to be under that flight path, it is extremely irritating and frustrating. On departure, it's quite different. On departure, there's no departure flight track that they follow electronically. It's a pilot's discretion based on clearances from the FAA, and as a result, you get more of a dispersal. So the event is louder, noticeably louder, but it's also spread out more broadly, so you don't have one concentrated dose to one particular group or segment of the community. And those are some of the characteristics you find that impact the community around the major airports.
I assume when you get into technical definitions of the 65 line and what DNL means and so on, we're going to talk about intensity, quality, frequency, dwell time, and all those things. Okay,
absolutely.
Good. I'll hold those questions so we get there.
Let me continue because we're on page one, and I've got about 30 pages So we've got basically some operational measures. The important thing is that I want you to realize that the preference runway system was designed and developed in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. It is now adopted worldwide by airports all over the world. But it was an inspiration that grew in Minneapolis and St. Paul under the original work of a group called MASAC, the Metropolitan Aircraft Sound Abatement Council, which ironically was created by the Metropolitan Airports Commission and Northwest Airlines. At that time, the executive vice president of Northwest Airlines, Benjamin Griggs, representing the airline as the number two person in that company, basically said we've got to do something about the environmental programs. And that discussion between MAC and Northwest Airlines started to put together a community group that was known as MASAC, and I'll talk more about MASAC later. But operational procedures were basically the earliest efforts to try to distribute the noise, minimize the noise, and maximize flight over open space. And that's what these represent. Let me just talk about a few of the important programs. We have a thing called the ANONS program, the Airport Noise and Operations Monitoring System. We have permanently installed in the community 39 monitoring stations. These are literally microphones mounted on telephone poles that gather 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year data on the operations of the airport. Citizens in the community can simply go to our website. They can tune in their specific neighborhood, their street address, and take a look at the noise impact from the nearest microphone monitoring our community. And the microphone, the technology provides the capability for us to basically interpret the information and determine where your home resides within the noise impact zone or how much noise you've been exposed to. So it's a very, very important public communication tool for us. We also use it to document some of our estimates and some of our forecast contours and really determine the real noise impact in communities.
Mr. Hamill?
Yes, sir.
Representative Adelson.
Mr. Hamill, these monitoring towers, do you have the ability to screen out ambient noise and road traffic noise so that you're getting a more pure jet noise reading?
Yeah, we do, and in fact you can see there have been occasions where citizens have tried to distort the information by farting the lawnmower and parking the base of the ball. The noise characteristics are quite different and quite easily identified. We can identify, and for example, the poles along 35W in South Minneapolis, you can pick out the traffic noise from aircraft overflight, and there's some very unique characteristics. So It's not distorted. It's tough to fool the system. It's been designed to monitor aircraft noise and noise activity. So, that data is available. The website was given to you. I would encourage you just to go ahead and dial that thing up and take a look at it. You'll find it very interesting. And literally thousands of people check that site a year, taking a look at their home. Pardon me?
What is the website?
The website is on, it's on about page 2, is www.mac.com. And if you simply look at that in your system, you'll be able to take a look at a complete array of arrival, departure, flight tracks, noise levels, airport activity. I don't know any other airport in the nation that has this thorough and this readily available an information source or system available to the community who live near the airport.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick question. Does this also monitor noise around Holman Field and Eden Prairie?
This does not. This is a system designed specifically for MSP. We have done monitoring and measurement around the other airports as well, but to be very frank with you, the big problem is MSP. We've got complaints from other communities, but this is where the lion's share of the activity and the focus on noise abatement takes place.
Okay. Can I just...
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. I'm assuming you're going to get, when you talk about Part 150 of the mitigation program, you mentioned that the ANOMS is used in relation to developing some of the models. When you get to that, if you could explain exactly how the ANOMS data ties into that, because historically there's kind of been an appearance that there's been a discrepancy between what the model says and what the actual ANOMS data is. So if we could talk
about that. Mr. Chair, let me just make very clear. What we can do is use the ANOMS system to validate or verify forecasts. We don't use it to actually do the forecast, but what we do is develop a forecast, and we can over time then evaluate or measure how that forecast compares to the real-world results. And you're right, there have been significant variations in some of the real-time information compared to what we had forecast the noise levels to be. Okay. The third operational, the third noise-related effort in Minneapolis is the Part 150 program. This program grew out of the Aviation Safety and Noise Abatement Act of 1979, known as the ASNA Act. It was a program developed by the Federal Aviation Administration, passed by the United States Congress, basically developed to develop procedures for noise and land use compatibility programs around the nation's airports. The FAA passed Part 150 of its regulation. Let me just digress for a moment. The FAA's regulation structure is divided into these numerical parts. Part 121, for example, is a regulation that oversees airline operations. Part 135 is a regulation that oversees charter aircraft operations. Part 91 is a part of the pilot licensing procedure. Part 150 is the federal government's, through the FAA, noise mitigation program. And that was adopted by the FAA in January of 1985. Basically, the Part 150 program was designed to provide procedures and standards and methodology to develop, basically to accomplish two tasks. One, to use a standardized methodology to develop these technical noise exposure maps, and you'll see them referred to as NEMs throughout this entire discussion. And those exposure maps are basically a snapshot or a picture, which is in the back portion of your handout today, of the Twin Cities metro area in a series of lines or contours that define the intensity of the noise as you move away from the source, the airport, moving out into the community. Mm-hmm. And the second development out of the Part 150 regulation was noise compatibility programs. That is, airport programs that basically lay out our plan in working with the community to try to deal with and measure the noise impact and try to manage it properly. Talking specifically about noise exposure maps, the MAC has developed and used one noise exposure map up until this point in time from the beginning of this program. We, after the 1985 adoption by the FAA, started to develop, using a standardized methodology, a noise exposure map for the airport. In 1992, we basically adopted that noise exposure map, and that noise map forecasted the traffic levels of 1996. It was that baseline map of 1996 that we used to kick off the noise mitigation program that we have today. And we'll talk about some of the criticisms, of course, of the age of that map and why we haven't done further updates more frequently. But the bottom line is that is the basic fundamental map used by the Airports Commission to determine whether your home is eligible or not eligible for noise mitigation. We're now updating that program and have a draft 2007 contour that we are prepared to release and use that as the new guide replacing the 1996 map. But you need to understand that this is the fundamental baseline document used to decide whether your house is inside the impact zone or outside the impact zone. And so it's highly controversial. And I have to point out to the committee members, Mr. Chair, that it's absolutely essential that the Airports Commission identify and use a standardized procedure, and that once that line is drawn using a consistent procedure throughout, that there be no deviation or variation from the decision-making process. If you're inside the line, you qualify. If you're outside the line by 15 feet, you do not qualify. And by doing with there's some slight exception, there's just some common sense rationale, but basically that's how hardline they've been about the interpretation of this line. In any event, let me go on to talk about noise exposure maps. It shows the airport and the surrounding areas, as I've included and discussed, and it shows a contour that basically draws this noise impact zone in 5 decibel increments, starting at 75 decibels on the airport, 70 decibels, 65 decibels, and 60 decibels moving away from the facility. We'll take a look at those in a few minutes. Okay. The second portion of this program is the noise compatibility program, which is basically a program put together by the airport operator, airport users, local government, the FAA, to basically figure out ways to minimize existing noise and to manage future noise impacts and appropriate land use around the airport. The noise compatibility program consists of 2 basic elements: a series of noise abatement procedures. These are operational in nature, which runways to use, the flight tracks used by aircraft departing the airport, the procedures applied by the pilots when they depart the airport to minimize noise close in versus further out, the type of climb profiles, the direction the aircraft flies, and so forth. The second element is that of land use measures. And let me just digress for a moment on this point. The entire noise mitigation program that you'll find in any country, any airport around the country, consists of partnerships. And that partnership has got to consist of basically 3 key players. We call it kind of the three-legged stool concept. The first is the government has got to be involved. The FAA has got to basically provide standardized rules and regulations and requirements and kind of their expectations working toward minimizing noise emission level. The local airport sponsor has got to be engaged as a second part of this three-legged stool and basically working at the local airport level with operational procedures, working with the airline companies to try to fly during less sensitive time periods, to fly the desired departure tracks, to employ certain procedures within the aircraft so that, in fact, noise can be minimized. And the third leg in the stool is the community, the local community. If you don't have responsible land use planning and land use around the airport, the whole program falls apart. It requires the federal authority, the local airport and the airlines working together, and the local community making certain that we minimize impact around the nation's airports.
Now, just to interrupt just for a second there and inject an editorial comment for my team up here, Representative Larson mentioned Wilmer a few moments ago. MnDOT Aeronautics in the city of Wilmer just moved that airport because of incompatible land use, basically. Moving airports gets to be dreadfully expensive, particularly as you get larger and more important, like I think the legislature, this legislature went through about 15 years ago with investigating the MSP move. So team members here, you know, part of what we're doing is talking about land use compatibility, and this is the core of what we're getting at by having this presentation this morning. Thanks for letting me vent that.
Mr. Chair, let me just add to your comment because it's an important, it's probably one of the most critical points that you can make in this whole discussion on noise. And that is, if you have an airport, as Wilmer did, close to the community, and you're viewing the community as expanding over time, one of the most important decisions you can make in a community is now the time to locate a final distant location for that airport, or to let encroachment and homes build around the facility. And
which I think is the problem we're having in St. Cloud right now.
Exactly. Yeah. St. Cloud has a very, very similar situation where you have to preserve the land around an airport to maintain the environmental compatibility with the community. You know, we talked about, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, the dual-track airport planning process and the decision to keep MSP at its current location back in 1996 versus moving to a new site. Mm-hmm. While that process was going on, Denver was in the process of building the new Denver International Airport. Give you a comparison. Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport occupies about 3,100 to 3,200 acres of land. The Denver International Airport controls and secures 35,000 acres of land. Okay, we're 10% of the land area of the new Denver International Airport, and Denver still has noise complaints from a very aggressive community that's located as part of that 35,000 acres. Mm-hmm. You simply cannot secure enough land to protect yourself for ultimate future development of the airport. So it's a critical point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Larson.
First of all, let me say, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your indulgence in allowing my participation this morning. Given I'm not a member of the subcommittee, but I have a question for Mr. Hamel and Mr. Finney. As it relates back to the noise exposure maps, you described very well the process for which we arrive at a map and or how you arrive at your expectations for what the noise will be. And of course now as we prepare for the opening of the new runway, what is the reevaluation process? Obviously this could go in different directions. Perhaps the runway could be noisier than was forecasted, or with emerging technologies into the future that noise could be reduced. I know that you have to have hard and fast rules for how any program that ultimately is approved is decides on who may receive mitigation or not. How often is that reevaluation process looked at, and what's the process for that, just so we understand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I think there are two answers to the question. First of all, Part 150 itself indicates some criteria under which you should do a reevaluation of the noise maps. They identify, I believe it's a 1.5 DNL change as being significant, and at that point they recommend a reevaluation. The noise contours are generally good for about 5 years. The forecast contour under Part 150 is a 5-year forecast, so that would in theory have you updating the contours every 5 years at a minimum, all other things being equal. The Commission, as part of their conversations related to the Part 150 update, has talked about trying to build a trigger mechanism, if you will, into the approval such that if certain kinds of activity, whether it be night operations or hush-kitted operations or total operations, exceed a certain threshold, that would suggest that you should go back and take a look at the contours to see whether or not they had expanded or decreased to the point that you may want to do a more substantive reevaluation.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. Yes. I appreciate the answer. And maybe it's a request as you're going through your presentation. As perhaps you could provide a picture for us of what technologies we see changing this discussion into the future. We've seen clearly, you've talked about the past in which the differences between the impacts of landing and takeoffs. I know that there's technologies that are in the developmental stage that are very costly that will further reduce noise, and I think it'd be helpful for us to have that information as well.
I'm assuming that may be part of the presentation coming up here shortly.
It is. It's part of this discussion. I'm going to move more aggressive through the document.
Because I'm looking at the clock over Mr. Finney's head, which reminds me, Mr. Finney, would you just, for the tape, state your name and position, please?
Mr. Chairman, Nigel Finney, Deputy Executive Director of Planning and Environment for the Metropolitan Airports Commission.
Thank you for the housekeeping.
Okay. Let me kind of push through this land use item by just tying up an important point, and that is, when you look at land use, there are two choices. You can deal with preventative measures or corrective measures. Preventative measures are infinitely less expensive than corrective measures. Going back into a community and trying to redevelop and acquire land is an expensive, time-consuming, and quite frankly, an upsetting experience for businesses and individual homeowners. So if you can protect the space beforehand, that's what you definitely want to do. That's why St. Cloud is so critical right now. That's why Roma made the decision that they did as far as location of the airport. Just very briefly, you need to understand that when we do these contour calculations that Nigel just described and we update them, we use a standardized methodology known as the Integrated Noise Model provided to us by the federal government. There's a good deal of discretion tied into that modeling procedure, but at the end of the day, we basically use the same tool that other airports around the country use in measuring noise as part of this Part 150 program. And what that does is attempt to assure that you've got consistent treatment when you take a look at different airports. Minneapolis, St. Paul is no different than Boston, no different than New York, no different than San Francisco as far as utilizing the integrated noise model. They're very different airports, the standpoint of size and operation and activity, but by using the same computer model to draw those lines, at least there's a consistency across the country. And as this document points out, we count the number of operations as takeoffs and landings, the time of day, daytime versus nighttime is a significant factor. The types of engines, the types of airplanes used, the departure flight tracks, the climb and departure capability of the airplanes, the noise emission level on the front side of the engine versus the aft side versus sideline noise, all of these variables and many, many more, humidity factors and temperature impact, all of this is part of this computer model used to develop these contours. So when we decide to identify or assign an aircraft, the Northwest Airlines Airbus A320, one of the quieter technology airplanes out there, to a particular runway for departure, this model will identify that specific flight and to fly a profile with the noise level emissions throughout the course of its departure out of our area, and it does it for all of the hundreds and hundreds of flights that arrive and depart on a daily basis.
Mr. Chair, if I could,
Representative Thiessen,
who's responsible for, I mean, you said, and I understand that the integrated noise model is kind of a model, but someone has to choose what inputs to put into the model, and that's kind of the discretion you've been, I think you're referring to. Who's responsible for making, kind of deciding what those assumptions would be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we went through a process last year to come up with forecasts for 2007, which is the target year for the future contours. They were reviewed with the Commission. We also dealt with issues such as flight track temperature, humidity, runway use. All of those issues were discussed at an open house for public comment, and then the Commission made the final decision based on input from the staff.
And if I can just follow up briefly, because I think one of the concerns, and this is, I think, relevant when we talk more generally, that the communities have is on some of the assumptions that are made. You know, for instance, I think you're projecting U.S. growth in flight operations at about 3.5%, which is the U.S. model, but you know, MSP is, I think, generally considered to kind of be growing more quickly than the general average of airports around the country. And in fact, data from this year shows growth getting back up to historical number of operations, high operations. So, you know, so right in that situation, we're kind of underestimating in the model, you know, and we can go back in history, and we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that, you know, you have the model presented a kind of assumption about how many operations there were going to be, but in fact, even 4 years after the model went into place, we're far in exceedance of that in reality. So are those accurate, and what can we do about them when we're planning for this airport and other airports?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I think to some extent they're accurate. Clearly, we are in a very different environment in terms of the aviation industry today than we were 5 years ago. I think there's a great deal of uncertainty as to what's going to happen with the industry. There was a great deal of optimism about their ability to recover this year, and suddenly fuel is at $38 a barrel, and you know, all of the analysts are changing their projections from a $500 million loss to a $2 billion loss in the industry this year. So I think we're still in a sorting out period, and I think to some extent that goes to the question that Representative Larson raised previously of what drives a reevaluation to ensure that what you thought was going to happen is in fact happening, and what corrective measures can you take to kind of get things back on track, if you will. And I think that's something that the Commission needs to deal with as they go through their discussion of what the future program is going to entail.
And if I can just follow up briefly, I mean, and I think that's a good point. I understand the reality of we are in a kind of a transition period, both in terms of the types of jets that are being used and a whole variety of factors. But it struck me that what's happened in the past and is happening again this time is that the projections and the macros that are making the assumption projections are erring on the conservative side, that there's going to be fewer operations and they're going to be quieter, et cetera. And it strikes me that if we are in a period of uncertainty and if we truly are in a partnership with the communities, et cetera, that we ought to perhaps be erring not on the conservative side, but perhaps a little bit more generously. And I don't know if you have a reaction to that thought at all. Or
what I'm hearing here is that there's been a yardstick that's been developed, and we all agree on the yardstick. How often we get the yardstick out and measure how deep the snow or the noise is what we're discussing here. Can I ask that we bring this back to the discussion about the yardstick for the next 42 minutes and stay away from how often we get the yardstick out to measure? Okay. This is important, Representative Thiessen, but...
Well, I think it's relevant to the discussion of what happens at other airports. If, mm-hmm. in fact, this we're talking about how this model is developed, and mm-hmm. if this model is not accurately reflecting what's happening, I think that's an important thing for the committee to understand. So that's my final comment, and I think they can answer the question quickly and we can move on. That's fine.
All right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, what we're touching on is the very kind of heart of the whole noise program, and that is that it's controversial. Interpretation, forecasting methodologies, how the airport works with the community to determine these noise exposure areas, the growth of the airport annualized over a short period versus a longer period of time are all things that are kind of the challenges that an airport administration faces in dealing with the community and trying to realistically portray the growth of an airport. We have actually been behind our own forecasts in the past, and we've been well ahead of them. It just depends on a particular snapshot or period in time. The information that we're now providing, the 2007 draft contours are out there, they're being evaluated now, we think actually represent a very realistic noise picture or noise snapshot of the community. There are folks in the community who will disagree with that, and we recognize that, and somewhere along the way we have to make a decision. As Nigel indicated a few moments ago, however, if we see a variation of significance, a decibel and a half from what we've projected as far as noise exposure, we can then go back and reevaluate our assumptions and take a look at updating those contours more frequently than every 5 years. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of those contours because there's actually some controversy associated with the frequency of our doing those noise measurement calculations. Let me try to continue to move through the handout. Day and night sound level, the DNL. This basically is the measure that's used to identify those contours. And it's important for you to understand, when we look at a contour in the back of the handout, that doesn't mean that there's a 65 decibel hum or roar in the background constantly. What that basically means is that you average the daytime and nighttime noise levels over a 24-hour period. And what that line represents is the average noise that took place over the 24 hours. So you're averaging the middle of the peak hour in the afternoon at 5 p.m. with constant heavy-duty activity when the airport's at near capacity, and you're averaging that in with 3 o'clock in the morning where there's virtually no or very, very little activity and no noise being generated. So DNL is the federally recognized measure with a nighttime penalty. That's why you have a day and a night segment to this calculation. But it's the average of the overall noise generated on the airport over a 24-hour period. So people can say to you, you know, I had a handheld Radio Shack noise monitor in my backyard, and it hit 97 decibels. What do you mean, 65 decibel contour? That's a single event that person just measured of the airplane going over their home at that particular moment in time, versus taking that event and averaging it with all the quietude between the events in the nighttime hours. So when the FAA determines 65 decibels or the 65 DNL as being the line that you draw between those people who have noise impact and are eligible for mitigation and those folks who are not impacted, it's that averaging process that the federal government used to make that determination.
At some point in this discussion, will you give us a definition or an example of what 60 sounds like, what 65 sounds like, so on and so forth? I mean, we all remember the Twins in the World Series.
Sure.
What were we doing?
We won the World Series that way.
Four? Yeah. I mean, it was painful. The noise was so loud it was painful. But can you give us a brief definition of how noise accelerates, and is it linear, is it exponential, or are you going to get to that?
We actually have a chart that we can provide the committee. It won't be available today, but we'll mail it to you, Mr. Chair, and that will give you kind of the ambulance, siren, fire truck down to the very quiet events and so forth, the lawnmowers down to a picnic area in the community. But generally speaking, 65 decibels is an average, is a fairly loud noise environment. If you cut the noise level by 5 decibels from 65 to 60, you cut the perceived noise level in half as heard by the human ear. And the inverse of that is that if you increase the decibel level from 65 to 70, you double the noise energy and double the perceived sound of noise that's received by a person on the ground.
So Mr. Chair, just to emphasize, though, what the witness said, I think this is really one of the critical points, is that this DNL is an average that takes into account silence and these very loud events. And, you know, when someone's living out their reality, it's the really loud events that you remember and not the silence. So when you're talking about 65 DNL and looking, well, that's less than a siren, I think what you got to think about is that when the planes go over, it's like a siren. So that I think that's a very important point for the committee to get.
Less than a siren running 24 hours a day. It's important that we remember how DNL is defined. So thank you, Mr. Hamill.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I've done this for almost 30 years. You can tell people and caution them about buying a home or living in a noise impact area. But until you move into the community and spend a couple of nights and actually experience living in the environment, you really do not understand the day in and day out impact of that noise. And I can't tell you how many people have called us and asked us for noise contours, asked for our advice on whether they should or should not acquire property. We don't give them that kind of advice, but we basically say, go out in the neighborhood, sit down there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon in your car, and just walk around the neighborhood and experience that noise. And then make a decision based on how badly you're bothered by the noise impact. And you really have to experience it. 65 decibels is a substantial amount of noise when you average it over the course of 24 hours.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, noise is measured logarithmically, not linearly. So it's a 5 decibel adjustment is a doubling of the perceived noise. And I just said that's when we give you the chart, you'll see how that's very graphically portrayed in the siren to the nursery comparison. Mm-hmm. The next page just takes us through a fairly quick history of noise abatement planning at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. I know the important message to start off with here is that we started seriously in this business in the 1960s. 1964, 65, Northwest Airlines and MAC got together, formed a separate noise organization, and in 1969 they formed the first joint citizens users noise group in the country known as the Metropolitan Aircraft Sound Abatement Council. MASAC basically survived for almost 30 years, and then there was a transition that took place. But during those 30 years, MASAC was basically the originator of some of the most unique and creative, innovative ideas on noise control and noise measurement found anywhere in the country and around the world. And many of the procedures, I'm talking 50, 60, 70 of the procedures that were developed with citizen and industry participation across the table, are still being used around the world today and now considered to be common practice. But things like the preferential runway system, which was virtually unheard of in the 1960s, early 1970s, has now become common practice. It was a direct result of 13 members from the community sitting across the table from 13 members of the industry working out some sort of an accommodation. A lot of pounding on the table, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion, a lot of emotion. But over the course of time, MASAC proved to be, I think, a significant contributor toward overall noise mitigation in this country. 1977, MAC adopted its overall MSP master plan, which included noise mitigation as a major part of that program. In 1979, we developed the noise operations or noise abatement operations plan. That was the first noise abatement operations plan that we know of anywhere in the country, although Boston Logan Airport had a very similar path that we followed. We were very, very close in our timing and our efforts toward managing the noise issue. In 1986, we developed a refined 27-point noise mitigation program. That was kind of a renewal and a revitalization of our program, identifying what old procedures were no longer effective and what new procedures could be implemented or instituted in the organization to reduce noise. We completed our first Part 150 program in 1987. Noise exposure maps were first developed in 1989. The noise compatibility program was submitted in 1990. Our airport planning and the Part 150 came together as part of the Airport Planning Act of 1989. That's when this body passed legislation direct the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to work toward the future planning and development of aviation needs for this community. What the legislature said, and it was a very interesting time in your history. In 1989, the legislature basically said, we've got an airport that has a serious noise problem located in the middle of a highly densely populated area. What's the future of the airport? What's the future noise impact of this airport? And should we, in fact, consider staying where we are or locating to a new location somewhere in the metro area? And that became known as the dual-track airport planning process over time. So very, very important action taken by this body that led to the planning of airport services looking 30 years into the future. In 1991, we did a Part 150 update, trying to improve these noise exposure maps. We approved one in 1993. We also did our comprehensive plan in 1994. And basically, out of these updates, our sound and residential sound insulation program began. And we basically took the 1996 forecast that was now available in 1992 and began to go out in the community and do two initial efforts. One effort was to start to insulate and treat schools that were inside the 65 DNL contour, at the same time begin the residential noise insulation program. Both very successful, very expensive programs, but 1992 was on the forefront, the cutting edge of this sort of noise mitigation fund anywhere around the country. In 1996, we kind of came to the end of our dual-track airport planning process initiated by the 1989 legislation of this body. Governor Ernie Carlson at the time basically said, enough is enough. You've been studying this thing for the last 6 or 7 years. Directed the legislature to pull itself together and make a determination on what the future of the airport would be. And in fact, the dual-track airport planning process came to an end, and this body did in fact decide to keep MSP at its current location. That was based upon operational growth and projections of the airport. It was based upon noise exposure and what we thought would be the improving environmental conditions around the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. The determination, quite frankly, was that the airport could meet future growth with certain accommodations or improvements made at the airport. And as a result, you've seen us now go into the largest expansion program of our airport system, one of the largest expansion programs in the country, a $3.1 billion airport expansion program that will basically culminate with the opening of the new north-south runway in October of next year. But this whole thing kind of came together as part of an ultimate future decision. And the reason this is so important is because, and I'll just use this as an example and digress for a moment. If you take a look at land use in the state of Minnesota and take a look at revenue generated that benefits the community, I don't think you're going to find another piece of real estate, another 3,000 acres, anywhere in the state that has more economic or financial impact on the economy of the state of Minnesota than the 3,000 acres that are occupied by the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Between $9 and $10 billion a year is generated at that airport, which goes directly into this community. It is a connection to the rest of the world, the rest of the United States. It is basically a measure of our business success in this community. Important point. The decision to slow down or stop the operation or the growth of the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is a decision, in my opinion, to slow down or negatively impact the economic vitality and the growth of the state of Minnesota and our metropolitan area. It is a very, very important piece of real estate, and it's a very, very important industry that has direct impact on our economy. It is also, I believe, the most valuable piece of real estate between Chicago and Seattle and as far south as St. Louis. Mm. There is virtually no other source of revenue generation that exists in that geographic region as does the 3,000 acres occupied by MSP. So it's an important part of the future and the history and the economic vitality of our community.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Larson.
Just a brief question. Mr. Hamill, can you let the committee know or inform the committee about what the estimated in 96 when the dual track legislation passed, what the estimated savings was to the state in terms of staying at MSP and not building the...
That's a question I was wondering whether to ask myself.
I think the best benchmark would be Denver. Nigel and I watched Denver develop very, very closely. Nigel was in Denver, Colorado frequently working and looking at that development. I joined him on occasion. They built the new Denver International Airport during this time period for about a little more than $5 billion, and have positioned the airport for future growth and development. They're now adding additional runway at the airport and doing further expansion in Denver. We looked at a similar price tag. If we were to relocate MSP to the Hastings site, for example, which was a site selected by the Metropolitan Council, it would have been about a $5 to $5.5 billion initial expense to relocate MSP and build a new greenfield facility 5 miles south of Hastings. We alternatively decided to spend at that time about $2.4 billion to upgrade and expand MSP, and that, quite frankly, was probably the most logical decision from the standpoint of public perception. Back in 1996, most members of this body and the citizens in the community, except for the folks living in the noise environment, noise impacted area, basically did not see or perceive a need to replace the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. They felt that it was an adequate, satisfactory facility that met the community's needs. But I think all of us recognize that sometime in the future we'll reevaluate and reassess the ability of MSP to further expand to meet the growing needs of this community as our region grows. We may find ourselves in a very different set of circumstances. But in 1996, when this decision was made to stay here, we actually were looking at the Denver Airport, as was this body, saying, do we want to do that or should we stay where we are? And the decision was made at that time to stay at our current location and expand to meet the accommodation. And we know that we can handle approaching 50 million passengers and somewhere in the area of about 640,000 takeoffs and landings a year at the current airport under the configuration that we're now finalizing today.
So, thank you.
Some very important points about that 1996 legislation, and I'd like to focus your attention to these three bullet points. First of all, we were nearly completed with the dual-track airport planning process when Governor Carlson asked the legislature to intervene. We stopped the process a bit short of the complete analysis, but in fact, Nigel and his staff and our consultants had done the vast majority of their work, and we were able to make, I think, very good decisions and provide information to the legislature to kind of lay out what needed to be done at MSP to implement this plan. Secondly, and this is a very important point, I'm going to read the language to you. You directed MAC to make recommendations on proposed mitigation activities to include the examination of mitigation measures to the 60 DNL contour. The legislature, in its language, directed the MAC to examine mitigation after the 60 DNL. And that's where the fundamental authorization comes from, the directive MSP, the MAC, to make this examination. What you need to also understand is that the federal government draws the line at 65 DNL. You ask us to go out to the 60 DNL, and that's what we are continuing to do to this day. I'm pleased to report to you, and we'll be more detailed about this later, but we have now nearly completed the noise mitigation of 7,800 homes, which incorporates every residential property inside the 65 DNL contour surrounding the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Total cost of that program, $225 million. So we are following through with our commitments. This airport has a long history of being dedicated and committed to noise mitigation and environment. We've demonstrated, I think, our wherewithal, and what we want to do is continue to encourage the airlines, the FAA, and the communities themselves to do their share in joining us in this effort to try to make sure this airport can be as compatible as possible. But that's a very, very important, critical element. This body, in its legislation, directed us to examine mitigation to the 60 DNL.
Mr. Hamel, quickly, where did the $225 come from to this point?
That money basically came from two sources, from grants from the federal government through the Aviation Trust Fund and through passenger facility charges. These are the $4.50 fees attached to every departing passenger out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and those are the dollars that are used to implement these strategies in this program.
Chair.
Representative Gill.
Mr. Hamel, where is the money going to come from the 60 to the 65? Is FAA going to pay part of that as well, or is that because we encourage that study and eventually probably some implementation? Who's going to pay?
I'm not going to overcomplicate the answer. Let me start by saying that within the lease between the Metropolitan Airports Commission and the airline companies that serve MSP, represented primarily by Northwest Airlines, we negotiated the 1997-1998 time period with our most recent lease, a $150 million set aside of dollars to finance noise mitigation efforts from 65 out to the 60 DNL. That $150 million is split into two parcels, $80 million contribution by the Metropolitan Airports Commission, $70 million contribution by the airline industry for a total of $150 million. We don't believe we need the whole $150 million to do an appropriate mitigation program, but that is yet to be determined as to what the details of that program are, and that's what we're working on over the next 60 days. The actual dollars, however, come from a variety of pots, but primarily from additional locally generated money through the passenger facility charge. We cannot and we will not receive any additional federal funds beyond the 65 contour because the federal government will not participate with us beyond 65 decibels. And that's the important thing.
That's the real question.
It is, exactly.
Okay. Is there another question over here trying to form? Not that I'm fishing for questions, mind you, but...
Well, just to follow up briefly on this 96 legislation, and the legislature, I mean, what's MAC's understanding? I mean, does MAC have an understanding that they're kind of committed to go out to the 60 DNL? I know that that's kind of been a public position taken by MAC in the past, and I just was wondering if that continues to kind of be the current position or where we are on that.
Let me take you to the next page in the handout to kind of address that in general terms, because it talks about the MSP noise mitigation program, and this is our take, our interpretation of what was directed to us, what we committed to when this was passed. Basically, we did form a noise mitigation committee. That committee went to work, and it did basically a substantial amount of work for us in looking at the whole noise impact area. We basically, that committee recommended and the commission adopted that we would have a full mitigation program for all homes out to the 65 DNL contour, and that we would incorporate and encompass additional contour and additional mitigation efforts out to the 60 DNL. The MAC approved those recommendations in October of 1996, and the State Advisory Council on Metropolitan Airport Planning concurred with those findings the following year in 1997. What we had basically committed to was a full insulation package for properties out to the 65 DNL. That package consisted of, in fact, I think it's incorporated in the page in the document. It's on the next page, I believe. Well, it's a couple pages down, but I'll tackle it and I'll skip over it in a few moments. That full package out to the 65 decibel level was designed to result in a 5 decibel reduction of noise experienced by the homeowner inside their home.
So if your intern rolls over with 60 or 55, when we finished our acoustical package on your home, it would drop by 5 decibels, or, if we call our previous conversation, a perceived reduction of cutting the noise in half. Mm-hmm. Okay? It was not based on any particular level because in Minnesota, our homes are already designed to meet our climate requirements with substantial insulation that cut a lot of the exterior noise. So the idea was to reduce the interior noise levels from the current experience down by 5 decibels. To attain that level of reduction, we had to do several things. One, replace the windows in the home, replace exterior doors, the front and the back door of the home, provide additional insulation in the attic, in many cases replaced furnaces and air conditioning systems, closed up various vents, put flue dampers on chimneys and so forth, as ways of trying to acoustically modify the home to achieve a 5 decibel overall noise level reduction inside the home. I'm pleased to report to you that we've gone back and done pre and post measurement, and in fact have met or exceeded that in almost every case. And homeowners are required when they receive this program to fill out a consumer questionnaire that does not come to us but goes to an independent authority. Those are evaluated, and we have like a 96 to 98% satisfaction rating on the overall program as being satisfactory or highly satisfied as a result of the program. We've had more than a half a dozen contractors who've specialized in doing these noise mitigation efforts on these homes. And basically, over the course of about 2 days, a contractor can go in on a bid, replace the windows, the doors, do the acoustical modifications to the property, and be out and have the homeowner completely satisfied with the professionalism of the contractor, the noise mitigation, and the final product, that is the appearance of their home. We realize this is a pretty aggressive intervention when you come in with a contractor and they tear the windows out of your house and take the molding off your windows and take the doors out of the house and start drilling holes in different places. But at the end of the day, when we walk out, folks are very, very satisfied with the professional and quality of the workmanship and the overall acoustical benefit of the property.
Okay, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Hamill, thank you. What is the current capacity now? This is my new understanding because I didn't realize that the 65 decibel was an average of the time. So what are we running at current capacity to stay within that 65 decibel measurement?
What are we running? I'm not certain that I understand.
I'm thinking in terms of the number of flights that we have within that are the determiner factor with the dead time, the average. So what type of capacity are we running right now? 65, 75% of that capacity to designate that 65 decibel line?
This is a little tricky, and I want to be really careful to qualify this, but let me give you the numbers first, and I'll explain why the numbers have to be very cautiously examined. Right now, we're at around 510,000 takeoffs and landings a year by commercial airliners. Mm-hmm. Okay, noise-generating heavy-duty equipment. It's being modified somewhat by the smaller regional jets, but let's just go with the number 510,000 takeoffs and landings. The capacity of Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is about 640,000 takeoffs and landings. We expect to be approaching that level in about the year 2020 or a little bit beyond.
And that's an operational limit.
That's an operational limit. That's correct. That's
640.
Right. So those 510,000 operations are what now generate that line, that 65 DNL contour around the airport. Logic would have you think that as the aircraft operations increase, more noise is generated, therefore the contour will move out from the airport and become larger. But in fact, just the opposite is taking place. With increased operations at the airport and the replacement of the older, noisier airplanes being replaced by the new quieter technology equipment and now smaller equipment than in the regional jet category, which is the largest growing category in the business today, we're seeing the same number of operations or slightly increasing operations with less noise being generated on departure for two reasons. Engines have been modified to emit less noise and aircraft are performing much more aggressively and efficiently today than they were 10 or 15 years ago. In other words, airplanes climb more aggressively and distances are, we love distance here. The farther away you are from the airplane, which is the noise generator, the quieter it is in your community. So you've got a quieter regional jet or a quieter Airbus A320 or 319, and you've got an airplane that climbs at a higher, more aggressive rate. And as a result, as the airport has grown from 1996 to 2007 contour comparisons, many, many more operations, but a smaller noise contour. Now, having said that, don't assume that the next contour after 2007 necessarily going to be smaller. We believe it will be just based on technology and advancements that can take place. But the reality is that there's a trade-off between an imbalance between the number and the level of operations, that is takeoffs and landings, and the noise emission received by experienced by the community below. But thus far, our projection of saying less noise impact, smaller contours over time with growing operations has been the reality.
Representative Adelson, Representative Severson, do you have any follow-up?
Well, I guess my follow-up would have been in regards to the RDC that's being planned in Rosemont here, the increased number of flights, and how does that weigh into the extension of the 65 decibel line?
Mr. Chair, the RDC is a regional distribution center. It's a cargo facility. Mm-hmm. The concept, very, very briefly, is to build a cargo facility somewhere in the Rosemont area, and I say Rosemont because they've initiated the effort to request it be the site. What you would have is a cargo distribution center where all the air freight that's intended to depart the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport would be taken to this distribution center off airports. It would go into this distribution makeup area where the containers would be constructed, and basically the repackaging would take place to put everything on these containers or these pallets, and then taken from the regional distribution center via a specialized truck to the airport where they would be loaded onto an airplane. You eliminate having to occupy a lot of airport property for a distribution center, a lot of this cargo makeup activity that you see taking place. And it's a very, very simplified, very efficient way of utilizing land both in Rosemont and at the airport. The assumption in Representative's question, Severson's question, is cargo is a nighttime activity. If we have significant increase in cargo handling capability or capacity, will that not drive more overall aircraft activity, and will that not also push more activity into the nighttime hours? And I think that now we're kind of benefiting from geography here. By virtue of the location, Minneapolis-St. Paul is a metropolitan statistical area in comparison to the destination points for these cargo operators. There are probably half a dozen serious cargo operators in the country, but there are two giants, Federal Express located in Memphis, Tennessee, and UPS in Louisville, Kentucky. In order for UPS and FedEx, as two examples, that's probably 80% of all the cargo that goes out of the airport, to meet their customer commitment of delivery by 10 o'clock the next morning for your package dropped off by 4 o'clock in the afternoon the day before, those packages have to be at the airport or have to be mailed by you, taken to the airport, put on the airplane, and flown out of here not later than about 10 or 10:15 p.m. to get into Memphis or Louisville in time to offload, reconfigure, repackage, and go out to the ultimate destination point.
What is the FAA definition of a nighttime flight again?
From 7 p.m.
7 p.m.?
From 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., I'm sorry.
7, okay.
So if an airplane departs at 10 or 10:30, while it's in the nighttime hour, it's not this midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning activity. The reverse is true, by the way, and then I'll wrap up very quickly. When the airplane comes back to deliver those packages in the morning, they typically leave Memphis and leave Louisville and come into the Twin Cities, arriving here after about 6 or 6:30 in the morning. So the nighttime hours by cargo operators are not what is perceived to be the problem. It's not FedEx and UPS flying in all hours of the night and day. It's a very specific schedule that leaves about 10 to 10:30 at night and comes back at 6 o'clock the next morning.
Mr. Chair, okay.
There's another category of flights that also concern me in addition to the cargo flights at night, and I found out about this when I accessed the noise complaint line. Even though it wasn't staff, you responded, and I appreciate that. And I had asked specifically because there was one early Saturday morning in late February where I happened to be woken up at 1 a.m., and there were three flights, one after another. And so I asked, what airline was this, where were these, and you sent the radar imagery. It was excellent. And from your correspondence, there were three charter flights within a half hour arriving between 1 and 1:30 in the morning, and I think at least two of them were Ryanair, and one might have been Champion. And so could you talk a little about charter operations in the middle of the night? And it seems like we could have a little bit more discretion over those than perhaps these cargo flights. And are you experiencing a growth in charter operations? And to what extent are we seeing those flights between, not to mention 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., but I'm talking about 1 a.m. to 5 a.m.
Now, we're talking Ryan and Champion. Are we talking about military flights or professional sports teams?
No, we're not talking military flights. We are talking about the Minnesota Gophers women's basketball team. and we're talking about Sun Country, and we're talking about Champion, two Minnesota-based airline companies that provide competitive low-cost air service. Let me explain the dynamic as far as charter activity goes.
A typical charter operator has got, normally they own the airplane, they lease airplanes, which means they've got to fly those airplanes for as many hours of the day as they can. In order for some country, as an example, to be effectively competitive and keep their rates low, they have to take that leased airplane, which is now a 737, 7 or 800, I forget which model, and they basically depart the airport at between 6, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning with their first bank, typically in the wintertime. That's typically southern fair weather flying down to Cancun, Puerto Vallarta, destinations in Florida and Arizona and so forth, and Las Vegas and the various gambling venues. They'll fly the airplane to Cancun or they'll fly it to South Florida. They'll offload the airplane, service the airplane, pick up the passengers who are now leaving their vacation to come back home, and they'll fly those people home arriving in the Twin Cities between, say, noon and 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the afternoon. Airplane will then be reconfigured, cleaned, refueled, ready to go for an early afternoon departure, 2, 2:30 or 3 o'clock, to fly back down to some sort of a sunny destination point, drop off that load of passengers, refuel, reconfigure, clean, and come back to the Twin Cities and try to get back in here by about 11 o'clock at night. I will have to tell you in all honesty that no matter whether it's a brand new airplane or an older airplane, it just takes a certain amount of time to refuel, to service airplanes. There are air traffic delays, there are weather complications. All sorts of things happen that basically interfere with kind of the greatest, most efficient plan. And as a result, while there are some scheduled arrivals during certain times of the year that do take place around midnight at the airport, they are typically charter returns from sunny destinations in the wintertime. The airlines are attempting to depart early in the morning, 6, return back in the mid and early afternoon, go back out and come back before about 10, 11 o'clock at night. And that's the goal. However, our facilities, destination facilities, weather delays, mechanical problems, and all sorts of other difficulties that take place in this business of transporting people interfere with that schedule. And as a result, we frequently see airplanes arriving at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't normally go much later than midnight or 1, and it doesn't happen all that frequently. But when it does happen, everybody is awakened by that arrival and that departure. And as a result, we get the phone calls, such as the one you described, Representative Hornstein, and we get those calls on a fairly regular basis, although the frequency is down significantly. It's a balance. The Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport is required by federal law to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We can't just shut the thing down at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night from a noise mitigation standpoint. I would argue that we economically, that would be a devastating action to take. So what we're trying to do in the airport management side of the house is try to figure out the best way to keep the facility viable and open to all users, meet the federal requirements so we can continue to receive federal grants and aid, and accommodate the airline's need and the traveling passengers' need, and not interfere with the residential community. And I will tell you that balance is impossible. You simply can't attain or achieve all of those goals. What's really kind of frustrating for us is that the wintertime is a time when Minnesotans travel a great deal. We are the largest charter travel market in the United States. More people want to get out of Minnesota in January than any other place in the universe, okay? So the very, very people who become very, very frustrated with the nighttime operation in October, they find themselves on vacation on some country coming back from Cancun at 1 o'clock in the morning and become part of the problem. How you balance that is to continue to negotiate and debate and argue with the airline companies to try to cut down those flights. And I will tell you that we've been very successful with the carriers that serve Minneapolis-St. Paul. Northwest over the years, and a long history of partnership with Northwest, have been trying to cut down nighttime operations. The charter companies try to work with us. Sun Country, as you know, is coming back. They are a revitalized, reorganized company. They are performing quite successfully, but they've got to have what's called this double shot every day. The early morning return, the afternoon return, nighttime activity, or they simply can't afford to continue to operate the level of service. And those charter flights, by the way, are for Minnesotans who are departing our community and coming back to our community. This is not a bunch of folks trying to go on to someplace else. These are people who want to come into this market or depart from this market. So it's our own citizens driving these kinds of schedules. And unfortunately, it does impact a certain segment of our community more severely than others.
Representative Adelson, I'm sorry I passed
you
over
you. I know Frank jumped in front of me, but that happens. Getting back to newer airplanes and performance, I've lived all around the world, been around the world. An airport that comes to mind is San Diego. They have a hill at one end and buildings at the other end.
Yes.
can MAC require, or does the FAA have to require different glide slopes? And, you know, these newer jets can basically do a 40-degree glide slope, taking off, come in at 4-degree landing. That would shrink your decibel area. Has there been any consideration of doing that?
Yeah.
Any hurt for the pilot?
Mr. Chair, listen, we looked at that, I would have to say, 10 to 15 years ago, adjusting the standardized glide slopes in and out of the airport. Especially, it's an arrival glide slope, not departure. The departure, the capability of the airplane to climb out, I have to tell you in all honesty, all airplanes fly basically the same way. If you load them up with fuel, load them up with baggage and people, and occupy every seat, and you throw the throttles up to full and max power for takeoff, the pilot's going to fly to get it to achieve an airspeed and acceleration, and whatever the bank angle is or the rate of climb is determined by the weight and the power and the thrust capability of the airplane. The pilot's not flying to achieve some sort of a reduced rate of climb out to be more comfortable for the passengers. We're way beyond those years. On landing, however, it's a different situation. On landing, the electronic glide slope, the instrument landing system, determines the rate of descent of the airplane. And once a pilot is directed by the FAA to line up on what's called the glide slope, he's basically flying, he or she is flying crosshairs to maintain an inbound course and an altitude and elevation. And that instrumentation will bring the airplane down to a point where the aircraft can be landed safely under all kinds of weather conditions. That glide slope can be adjusted from 3.5 to 4 to 4.5 degrees. I will tell you, however, though, that the commercial airliners today, it would be a pretty tough approach if you were to attempt to land on a 4 or 4.5 degree glide slope. The problem you run into is trying to pull the throttles back and slow that airplane down. They're so clean that if you're not right on the proper airspeed when you initiate the descent, you're not going to slow down on the final
approach.
Sounds
like the first pilot.
Yeah, that's right. Spent a lot of years talking and instructing in airplanes. And even with, for example, the C-13, you got these great big props hanging out there. You go to 40 or 45 degrees, which the airplane is designed to deal with, you've got to have the props completely flat. And jet airplanes don't have props to help you do that. They're just too slick and too clean. We flew a DC-10 simulator trying to fly a 4-degree glide slope, 4.5 degree, and we couldn't slow the airplane down to get the landing speed to land the airplane safely. And this was in the cooperation of Northwest Airlines giving their simulators to our people to do this sort of an evaluation. And a 40-degree or a 40-degree slope or 40, whatever the term was you used, is, I think, not realistic for us.
Well, with the newer aircraft, is the noise more with the takeoff, isn't it, than the landing?
Yes,
when the airplanes are just hanging on the blades, basically.
It is. Throttles are basically retarded to almost idle.
The steeper takeoff, John Wayne's another good example.
Right.
The takeoff at extreme angles.
What really drives the pilot's decision-making process in San Diego is a very adverse environment. A short runway, buildings, and hills. And so they kind of puckered up when they fly the approach into San Diego. And it's flown very, very differently, very aggressively in comparison to Minneapolis. And to be very frank with you, we shouldn't encourage that kind of flying in Minneapolis-St. Paul. I think the safest, consistent
procedure. What I'm getting at is, with the newer technology, the higher angle of takeoff is going to
shrink
your window.
And I would think, too, that to further that point, because of the way sound falls off, and we may get to this eventually in the next 3 minutes, but the way sound falls off is a square of distance or something like that. I remember high school physics, but a landing approach is necessarily a long, low, close to the homes. Even though the aircraft is in a quieter configuration, it's closer to the residents. Where a takeoff, even though it's a noisier event, usually is they're higher because
right.
They climb faster than they can shoot an approach. So they have an effect on the DNL line, right?
Exactly. And on the landings, Mr. Chair, on the landing, it's the same course.
Over and over and over
flight
again.
Flight after flight.
Takeoff, we can already be turning on course as soon as we're past the
frequency
pump deal.
The frequency combined with the noise level.
Runway 17, then, the way it's configured and angled out over the valley and over commercial property, has that been figured into this 2007 plan yet?
Absolutely.
In particular, nighttime departures, when the winds die down and winds aren't quite a factor, that I'm sure that you've already thought of these things.
We have. There's an extensive program that incorporated not only the MAC and the FAA, but the community representatives as well, to work out departure procedures and specific departure flight tracks on the new runway 17, which is going to open in October of next year. Southbound departures only on that runway, unless it's a bona fide, serious emergency.
Yeah.
There are numerous flight tracks that disperse traffic south of the airport, maximizing flight over the river bottom and the preserve area of the Minnesota River Valley. Mm-hmm. So in fact, we got good dispersion and good altitude before we get to the first residential areas.
Mr. Chair, on that, just quickly, just to share with folks, that runway is going to be, I think, the closest runway to any residential area in the whole United States, the actual location of the runway to where houses are. And I just wanted to point out for the committee, we can talk about this later, one thing that the DNL analysis doesn't take into account is the low-frequency noise.
Correct.
And I know that there's work being done on the federal level about that, but that's something that just is not kind of part of the discussion at this point. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
I'm going to ask you a question about that in just a moment, but I need to make this announcement. We have this room until 11 o'clock if we wish. This gentleman can stay, can my staff, for a little bit longer? Any of you other folks that can stay would be appreciated, and we'll carry this on for at least another 15 or 20 minutes, because I want to get to some more technical stuff here that impacts what we're doing around the countryside.
If the quality
of the sound, go ahead. Then
I got to run out for a little while, and I'll come back. But if I could just, one thing that I just want to bring closure on is the 60 DNL, and you know, in your answer, is it the max position that there is some noise mitigation that is committed to going out to the 60 DNL? And just kind of a simple answer on that.
Mr. Chair, the answer is yes. At this point in time, the Commission does have a policy to deal with mitigation measures out to the 60 DNL. That will be evaluated and reaffirmed by this current board as to what that program truly is and what the mitigation measures are. And I cannot forecast for you what will happen in the next 60 days. But the current policy of the Commission is to provide mitigation out to the 60 DNL in varying degrees depending upon exposure.
Thank you.
When we're talking about noise, intensity, quality, and so on and so forth, you know, we've got people with big low bases in their Honda Civics, it appears. That seems to be the car of choice for putting those big things in. That sound seems to penetrate concrete, for crying out loud.
Low frequency noise.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem to be very loud. It's not like it makes my ears painful. I can feel it. Fingernails on chalkboard certainly may not be achieve even 60 decibels of level, but certainly makes your hair stand on end. The chimes at the courthouse or the local church, you know, at 5 o'clock are ringing the hour. They're obviously very loud, but they impact us differently.
Right.
How are the qualities and the aggravation levels of different sounds and level, how does that figure into this whole thing?
There are numerous ways of measuring noise, and I'm going to oversimplify it, but I think it would be satisfactory for the committee. Because number one, I don't have the technical background to get into the physics of noise, I can't do that for you. But let me suggest that when we measure noise that you hear,
mm-hmm.
it's measured. Decibels are measured on an A-weighted scale. In other words, there's an adjustment to the way it's measured to reflect the irritation on the human ear as you receive the noise.
So there is a sense of subjectivity in this whole thing.
There is.
Okay.
But the scientific community has quite frankly adopted this, and it's universally accepted around the world. So mm-hmm. when we talk about decibel that you hear, we're talking about the A-weighted scale, so we say dBA. The noise the sound energy you feel, the low frequency noise that was representative Thiessen mentioned, is low frequency noise measured on what's called the C-weighted scale, dBC. And that's low frequency vibration. You can hear a hum, you can hear the noise, but basically what you're doing is you're feeling the intensity of the noise, those low frequency waves. And as you indicated, Mr. Chairman, those frequencies penetrate and pass through the ground primarily. So when you try to provide a mitigation measure, putting more insulation on your house is not going to solve the low frequency noise vibration problem. It will handle the A-weighted noise you hear, but it won't deal with the vibration factor. The reality is that we don't have enough science yet to determine what it's going to take to provide adequate mitigation to reduce low frequency vibration type noise. We've been in the forefront of this analysis. The City of Litchfield and MAC jointly worked on a study together on low frequency noise. We had kind of the battle of the consultants. Litchfield had their consultants, we had ours. We had a third consultant that was kind of the neutral third party to break the tie. At the end of the day, the analysis that was done by all of those consultants working together was determined by the FAA to not be an adequate description and identification of the problem. And basically that work is now being improved and refined and worked on again.
When you talk about low-frequency noise, I guess the answer that I would provide the committee today is we just don't know enough about it yet, but it's another way of measuring noise, and I happen to believe that if we determine that low-frequency noise, that is vibration, becomes a mitigatable, if that's a word, environmental phenomenon, it will be an extremely expensive whole new noise mitigation program for airports across the country. And we're just not there from a science technology standpoint yet. But we've been in the middle of that controversy for the last half a dozen years or more.
Okay. Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Larson.
Thank you. Mr. Hamill, can you tell us a little bit about, I know that there's some currently some study that's about to occur on low-frequency noise. And my understanding was initially the idea was to have that study occur, I think this was federally funded, at MSP, because the issue sort of grew out of the runway 17. And can you tell us the status of that? Because my understanding is that's now shifted, and perhaps this won't be the test site for that. And can you tell us a little bit about that? And I'm also interested in the point you raised, Mr. Chair. As I know, in the past, one of the ideas was to create a barrier between the community and the airport, whether it be concrete, to create a that barrier between to stop the low frequency noise, right, if you will. And I know initially the science was that the noise just travels around it,
through it.
Can you tell us if there's any development in that discussion and where we're at with that?
Mr. Chair, the second question first, if I may, for Representative Larson. As far as concrete subterranean barriers and barricades, I think it's safe to say we just don't know. The analysis and the tests and studies that have been done show some improvement under certain conditions, but a lot of it's dependent upon the geology, the terrain, the use of the land, the distance, and so forth. It's just a tough issue to deal with. I live in Mendota Heights, 6 miles from the airport as the crow flies, and on Sunday mornings I can feel the 747 long-haul departure. I can't hear the airplane, I can feel the vibration at my home 6 miles away. And yet, what's interesting is that the vibration is not necessarily worse 3 miles away. We just don't know enough about the vibration and how to control it. And that's one of the problems that I have personally with low-frequency noise mitigation. One of the biggest mistakes that we can make is representing to the community that this is a manageable, solvable problem, when in fact we just don't know if we've got the technology or the science today to truly deal with and aggressively approach the problem. And I think it's an injustice on the part of people like myself to represent to a community that we could do something and we're not. I think we should be upfront about it, simply say we just don't know enough yet, it needs to be further studied. Which brings me then to your first question, where are we on our study? As you know, we committed to the city of Richfield in a partnership that we'd take a look at and study low-frequency noise. Richfield has been very, very aggressive and pushing very hard, and I think that's that's a tribute to them and their aggressive nature toward trying to come to some conclusion on this issue. The first study was basically determined to not be satisfactory. There's now an effort led by Congressman Sable as far as a funding mechanism in the city of Richfield to redo the analysis. To be very frank with you, we believe that study being conducted in Minneapolis-St. Paul is going to run into some certain biases. There are two parts of the study. There's kind of a social survey aspect of the study, which basically asks the citizens kind of their impression of low-frequency noise. There's another side of it, which is basically the actual measurement of low-frequency vibration. The measurement portion can be done on any runway anywhere in the country. In fact, we don't have a runway available to do that because the logical runway would be the new 1735 runway very close to the city of Richfield. But that runway won't be available for operations until October of 2005. Mm-hmm. So first point, we think that the actual physical measurement should not take place in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And it doesn't make any difference. Whether you take that San Diego runway that was mentioned or Chicago or Minneapolis, the characteristics of low-frequency noise emitted by an airplane going down the runway and taking off is going to be the same. Simply take that template and put it over the top of 1735, and you can identify the low-frequency impact. The social survey, however, is more controversial, and I'm encouraging that we not, and suggesting that we not do the social survey in Minneapolis-St. Paul either, and that is in direct contradiction to the city of Richfield and Congressman Sable, which is a delicate issue for us, but here's my rationale. And this will be the recommendation I make to our chair. We believe there's been so much local discussion and such an intense interest in this issue that to conduct a social survey in the community, asking residents their feelings or their views, might not give us the most objective data or information as a database. Furthermore, we need to do more than one location. There need to be multiple social surveys done in numerous locations around the country. And I think our real goal here is to try to get as objective a database the social survey as possible. And I believe there's been so much controversy and so much attention given to this issue, particularly in the city of Richfield, that we may not get that objectivity in our community. What we will do is benefit from both the noise measurement and the social survey data, no matter where it's done, and we can apply it in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And we are, quite frankly, well ahead of the rest of the country on this particular issue. But the real crux is the scientific background and the knowledge base that simply isn't there yet, in my judgment, at this point in time. Tough issue. Controversial issue for us.
As noise quality and intensity has changed over the years, I'm thinking back to when the airport was first located, when it was piston-powered Globemasters or something along DC-7s, things like that. They were loud, but was the quality of the sound different? And I'm thinking it was lower frequency.
Yeah, it was.
I'm thinking in the morning, every morning at 5:30-something when the Beach 18 comes over my house, it's almost, to me, and maybe it's just my subjective experience, a pleasant sound. I can feel it coming before I hear it. But it's nothing that, you know, tears me out of bed like, oh my goodness, what was that? With the stage, what we call stage 1, 2, 3, 4 engines and so on that are going on, the low moan and the low groan of a fully loaded 747-400, is that perceived to be a less aggravating or annoying sound than, say, a 727, the business end of a 727?
Mr. Chairman,
and can you, when you explain, you talk a little bit to us about what the stage engines mean, what that was
okay.
about.
First of all, you're talking about personal subjectivity.
Which is hardly measurable, yeah.
In all the years, and I was a manager of noise at the commission for the first 4 years that I was here, and literally in the neighborhood every day with noise boxes and interviewing folks and picking up the telephone. And I would receive a call from one person who would call and talk about how horrible the noise is. It's absolutely unlivable. Mm-hmm. And his neighbor would call and say, his next door neighbor is nuts. Doesn't bother me a bit. I love airplanes. The noise doesn't bother me. Don't worry about it. And you go crazy. But there's kind of an overall judgment that you make over the course of spending a career in this field, and you kind of get a sense of kind of what's a kind of practical reality here. And I would say that if you were to take the old propeller airplanes, the DC-6s, the DC-7s, the old Globemasters that flooded this airport in the 50s, and compare those airplanes with the Boeing 707, the Boeing 707-320, the first generation commercial jet airliners that were nothing more than military derivative engines mounted on a civilian airplane. There was a dramatic shift in the type of noise, the noise characteristic, and the sheer volume, the intensity of the noise generated by that jet airplane. But people didn't complain much. And the reason they didn't is because they were kind of awestruck by the fact that this thing flies without propellers, and people couldn't understand that concept. So there was a novelty, and it was kind of cute for about the first 5 or 6 years. And all of a sudden, more and more jets started to arrive, and all of a sudden folks realized this is the future, more and more of this. And as we replace the propeller-driven airplanes with these new noisy jets, it's going to become virtually horrendous. That's what led to the community revolt in Minneapolis and St. Paul, that led to the airline and the airport working together to form MASAC, a citizens group, that led to all the mitigation that we've developed over the last 35 years. So it's been a very aggressive, very involved, very participating community. If we're going to roll the clock forward, if you were to tomorrow morning put those DC-7s and DC-6s back at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and start to depart on a daily basis, and compare that with the jet operations today, my judgment would be that the community would go absolutely crazy. And the reason they would is because the airplanes would be loud. They would have a combination of volume and more vibration because of that low frequency business. And airplane performance would be atrocious in comparison to today's technology. So low flying, prolonged, 45, 50, 1 minute, a minute and a half prolonged events away above 65 decibels with a combination of high volume and vibration. I think you would find the reminiscent sort of affection we have for the old prop days.
The nostalgia
wouldn't carry you through the day, no. And there's a dramatic difference between the jet airliner today. When Northwest takes delivery on a new 757-300 or a new Airbus 320 or their brand new 330, That airplane, those airplane categories are dramatically different than the DC-9 that's being flown by Northwest today in its current fleet, and totally different than the other general airplanes that Northwest has since flown and retired. I talk Northwest because, quite frankly, they're our largest partner. They're 82% of the operation at Minneapolis-St. Paul National. They're criticized for flying this very, very old fleet, but the reality is that they're getting rid of those old DC-9s, which are marginal Stage 3, but they are Stage 3 compliant airplanes. If they weren't, they couldn't fly in the United States. And they're being replaced by new quiet technology Airbus 320-319s, and most recently by the regional jets, which are dramatically quieter than even the Airbus series airplanes. They're smaller capacity, 50 to 70 passengers, but they're noticeably quieter and perform better. So I think the environment today is dramatically improved over the environment of even the prop days, but it's the combination of changing technology. No one ever imagined 50 years ago or 40 years ago the level of this operation. If you had said to me in 1977, when I joined the Airports Commission, someday we're going to be the 8th largest airport in the United States and the 12th largest airport in the world, we would have looked at you like you were crazy, okay? But we are. That's where we are today. And we'll continue to hold that very competitive position so long as Northwest Airlines uses Minneapolis-St. Paul as a major operating hub. And we think that's going to continue. We believe that we have great confidence in Northwest Airlines. So we're going to be an important part of the air transportation system of this country for a long time to come. And we're going to be an important player and very, very busy. It's incumbent upon all of us to work toward trying to find the quietest combination of airplanes to serve the greatest number of people who need to travel out of this community. And that's the trick in this business. You cannot pacify or satisfy both sides of that equation. So that's kind of my diatribe on noise.
I'm thinking that we may want to wrap this up unless there's any concluding questions or comments. Before I go to Representative Larson, I just want to let the committee know that an offer has been extended to us to actually go to MSP, visit some of the noise monitoring sites, and look at some of the noise attenuating programs that have been going on out there. We may do that while we're still in session. We'll try to do that while we're all in town and make that happen one of these days, which may trigger some more questions about how this whole thing works. As chairman of this committee, I'm a map kind of guy. Thank you for the maps. In fact, we may want to take just a few moments to talk about how this has changed back here on whatever page number this is. By the way, a suggestion, I like page numbers.
Okay.
It makes things a lot easier going forward in the future. But as we're thinking about what our friends at St. Cloud are trying to do and what Rochester's trying to do, Duluth to an extent, Wilmer, for crying out loud, Marshall, where I know they're anticipating some things, a very aggressive, civic-minded group down there that wants to rebuild that airport. I want the committee members to be cognizant of what these DNL lines mean. I think we've learned that today. And at some point, we'll actually be able to stand and listen with our own ears at what 60 sounds like. Then we'll move over and hear what 65 sounds like. And if I have my way, we'll stand at the end of the runway and hear what that sounds like, so that we know what planning commissions are dealing with when we're trying to do compatible land use planning around the state, okay? Representative Larson, you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps at the end of that tour, we can have the picnic in my backyard and find out what, what between 65 and 70 might sound like. But I'm going the other direction, maybe between...
See what we can do to attenuate noise at barbecues.
But right, right. And I misspoke. It's actually not as noisy as the 60 does not get to my house, but you would find out. Mm-hmm. Even in the zone that's outside of what we will mitigate noise at, right, it's significant. My fear in having that kind of event at my house is that's the day that the 422 runway wouldn't be used, and you'd think that I'm all the questions that I ask.
He's the nutty neighbor.
That's right. Yes, I'm the one ringing the phone. I want to go back to a question that Representative Severson had asked regarding the RDC, and we had the conversation in Transportation Committee regarding that proposal when we heard that. And some of the questions that I had asked of the proponents are better posed to you, and that is, what are the estimated increases in traffic as a result of that vision being implemented? And then if we could get a little information about what runways cargo uses because of the weight that, as I understand it, sometime, I guess how the proposal was relayed to us was that these are fully loaded 747, so they're heavier, they're some of the heavier aircraft they're going to be utilizing. Which runways is important for us to know?
I came today prepared to talk about Partway 50 and noise issues, not cargo, but let me just offer the fact that, that I will have to take a look at the actual forecast. What generated that RDC, that regional cargo distribution center analysis, was the realization that about between 60 and 70% of all the manufactured goods produced in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area in the state of Minnesota that ultimately find their final destination via air are actually trucked to Chicago every day. People don't fly cargo out of Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. What they do is they take their manufactured goods, put them on a truck, and drive it to Chicago, put the merchandise on the airplane in Chicago, and fly it to worldwide destinations. So the question was asked, would Minnesota businesses, you know, Medtronic, Cargill, 3M Company, you can name the top 20 or 30 corporations in this community, would it enhance their competitiveness? Would it provide a more stable environment, a more economically viable environment for them if we did have direct international cargo flights out of Minneapolis-St. Paul? The answer we got back was yes, but you have to recognize that not everything has to be delivered overnight or within a day or two. There are a lot of things manufactured that can take their time to get to their destination because they're not time sensitive. So then the question becomes, how much time sensitive goods and services are produced. Goods are produced in this community that need to get to their final destination point. And that's part of a much more involved analysis that I don't have off the top of my head. But I will tell you that 70%, nearly 70% of our cargo being flown out of Chicago tells me that there's a real need for some sort of improved cargo capability at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. But not until the business community demands that we have that kind of service and a cargo airline company recognizes that demand and responds, are we going to see any real action? FedEx now provides, I think it's 5 days a week, nonstop service Minneapolis-St. Paul to Tokyo. They are constantly expanding and evaluating their route structures, as is UPS and some other carriers. And they seem to be meeting the need or the expectation or demand of the community at the present time. And until those demands or needs change, I don't see a very aggressive shift. So it could be a slow transition over time. The runway question that you had, our runways at the airport, 10,000 feet, 11,000 feet, are completely adequate to handle any of the fully laden cargo carriers that operate in the United States and around the world today. We don't have to have longer runways than we have at the present time to operate 99% of all the flights that would go anywhere in the world.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hamill, of the runways that we have, is there any preference in terms of or any advantage to using one runway?
Yeah, the runway 422 is 11,000 feet long. It is the longest runway. It's the one that goes from Highland Park in St. Paul toward the corner of 494 and Cedar in Bloomington. If a pilot in an aircraft requires that the load demand the longest available runway for the safest operation, that would be the first choice. Second choice is a 10,000-foot south parallel runway, runway 12 right, 30 left.
And Mr. Chair, just as a final comment, the reason I raise the question is that when the RDC legislation was presented to us, the folks that were advocating for it, in their information, had said that any increase would be a statistical non-event, I think is how they had quoted it. And in knowing that a heavier plane would use 422, it depends on how many flights, how much of a flight increase there might be on that runway, but it wouldn't take a lot of flights to significantly increase the percentage. And so I just want, as we move forward on that conversation as it relates to the RDC, and I'm not making necessarily an argument against it, and obviously the increased commerce that comes with a facility like that, but we also need to recognize the statistically, in terms of the whole airport, the impact may not seem significant. However, it may well be in terms of the folks that are most impacted by the 422.
Mr. Chair, it's an important point. If you have one or two flights a day going off of that runway, and that increases by one or two flights, that's an increase of anywhere from 30 to 100% traffic. And people do notice that. I think the vast majority of the airplanes we're talking about are still compatible with the 10,000-foot parallel runway, and I think statistically it would be an insignificant amount of activity. But I think your concern is legitimate. I think it's worth exploring. I think you should demand that the folks who do these forecasts and look at the increase in activity should give you an appropriate response. But I don't think it's, I think we're not talking about a serious noise event for you in the next, I would guess, half a dozen years or more.
And I guess as a follow-up, because, Mr. Chair, this will be my final follow-up, and that is, in terms, have the folks that are advocating for the RDC, have they come to you for your opinion on that issue? And so when they talk about forecasts, are they using data that, I'd have to go back and see what they source, but I'm curious if you provided them anything, or if they're, you know, basing it on their own assumptions.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I actually have a staff person, Steve Anderson, our staff, who's our cargo guru. He's our expert. He attends all of these meetings. He participates in the discussion. He has access to all departments, all information. So we feel that we have more than adequate input into the decision-making process, which includes not only development concept, but also the statistical data on flights and demand and so forth. And I think that we're comfortably covered by Steve's participation with that group.
So. Well, thank you, Mr. Hamill. On what amounts to page 12 of the handout is two overlays. Apparently what we're looking at here is the 1996 plan that you had been working from, and then the 2007 that you proposed to work from or that's under consideration now.
Correct.
And I noticed it takes into account increased activity, looks like takeoff activity on runway 17, and it looks like operations on runway 22 have shrunk considerably.
So we shifted the contour more to the east and directly south. The green line represents the 1996 noise impact, 65D in our contour, which is the one that we're using today to identify noise impacted homes and locations. And the purple or the black line is the new proposed contour for 2007 that has not yet been fully adopted, but is our proposal. We think that's very accurate to what we'll see finally passed.
Okay, and members, then the rest of the packet is data and so on concerning the Part 150 program that's been in place, number of homes, number of dollars, where those homes are, and so on and so forth. Thank you for putting this together for us, and I'm sorry to have to kind of rush to wrap things up here. This is, personally, I'm challenged and enjoy the scientific explanation and thinking through the math on these things. I hope we've all gotten a little deeper in this business, particularly as we, for those of us that are back next year, we wrestle with the how we give airport authorities around the state more tools in their toolbox to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. You know, dealing with it after the fact is always much more annoying and expensive than trying to be proactive and attacking it head on before the problem happens. That's what we hope to do. Any further comments, conclusions? If not, Representative Mr. Hamill.
First of all, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's always good for us to be able to talk to leaders in our community, and we really believe that you need to understand the kind of the operation of this airport. It's important to the community. There's a delicate balance that exists. You know, constituency comments and complaints. In the 1990s, in many ways, we were receiving 28,000 complaints a year from residents around the airport, so it was not a small problem. It was huge. Those complaints have dramatically dropped off because of our Part 150 program. We appreciate the direction and the guidance that you've given us. Please take advantage of our invitation. When the session's over, get a hold of us. Come on out. Spend a half a day with us. We'll have lunch, and we'll even cater that lunch in Representative Thiessen's yard. And we can enjoy, I think, an afternoon looking at what's not only happening today from an environmental standpoint, but it would be great for this community to understand the development and the money that Nigel has spent building this $3.1 billion expansion program for the community's overall background as well. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
And may I introduce Commissioner Cole Hull.
Well,
sitting here, she's one of our commissioners, I think.
We have a couple of commissioners here, I think, actually, don't you?
Where are we here, Jordan? Commissioner Burton Appleseed, the Vice Chair of the Commission, and Commissioner Coyle Hull, former Mayor of Bloomington, now Commissioner on the MAC, are two of our commissioners here today to be present.
And let me say thank you for serving. This is very important stuff.
Thank you.
With that, we stand adjourned.